continuing our kind of a breast cancer series that we have going to kind of backwards. Dr. Edge talked about surgery. Dr. Dot has agreed to talk a little bit about some clinical trials that have just been completed with breast cancer. Next week, we're going to have a Zoom lecture, and I think you have something to know about. We're going to go long on Tuesday, just to let you know, it'll be about an hour and a half. And come on.
I have to be there anyway because of cancer pathology.
That's right. How many of you guys are in cancer pathology? Okay, so there is some overlap. That's helpful. So hopefully we can get the rest of the fun out of the room. Okay, Thursday, the genetic counselor, June Mickelson, is going to come back, and she's going to talk about counseling in the setting of breast cancer, and it's just not BRCA 1 and 2. So she's going to talk about how you deal with the patient and that whole differential. And then Dr. Jessica Young is going to finish up the semester talking about surgery and treatment and the clinical aspects. So she's on vacation, so everybody's going to move around a little bit differently. But you'll be experts in breast cancer by the time she left your training. So I don't want to take any more time from Dr. Dot. Thank you for coming and visiting us again. You've probably been our most regular lecturer through the whole year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon. So today what I'm planning to do is to take you through what it takes actually to a project all the way from the basic research, from the bench. If you think that there is a potential for translation, how to take that all the way to a clinical trial. And so you would see, like, what are the rationales for the, what's the rationale for behind many of the decision making to start the trial to begin with, and how you proceed, what you change during the course of time, and how easy or how difficult it is to conduct a real clinical trial in real human beings compared to most of what you do, like in cell culture or in animals. It's a completely different ballgame, and you already heard from the clinician perspective. I'm sure Steve Edge gave a really good history of how breast cancer surgery evolved. And again, as you just heard, next week Jessica Yang is going to delve more into the therapeutic aspects of breast cancer. So here I thought I'm coming from two sides, from the basic research and how I, along with a huge team, I show you, took it to all the way to the clinic. So breast cancer broadly divided into luminal cancer, luminal A and B, and basal-like, and HER2 overexpressing or HER2 enriched. And overall, this is luminal A constitutes about 45%, luminal B followed by 25%, and triple negative or basal-like breast cancer, 20% of all the breast cancers, and about 10% of breast cancers are HER2 enriched. Now, some of this you already know. ER-positive and PR-positive breast cancers, which these two, usually are treated with endocrine therapies, obviously, because they have these receptors, especially estrogen receptor alpha, and they are also treated with the chemotherapy such as doxorubicin or adriamycin, and radiotherapy, and obviously surgery. And then in the case of HER2, back from various lectures you might heard, including mine earlier in Oncology 1, HER2 overexpression, the membrane tyrosine kinase receptor, and if HER2 overexpression or amplification mess up with the signaling in the cell, and that leads to particular type of breast cancer like HER2 enriched. That's a bad part. The only good part is that there is a targeted therapy pretty efficient against this cancer. So even though some of them still are resistant, but at least you have a targeted therapy, trastuzumab, which is targeted against the outside region, extracellular region of the receptor. Now the basal-like is the most challenging. It is also triple negative. Most of these belong to the triple negative category. And as the name implies, it doesn't have ER, it doesn't have PR, and doesn't have HER2. So there are no targeted therapies available as of today. The main therapeutic regimen for these patients is still generic chemotherapy. So these cancers initially respond very well to chemotherapy, sometimes even better than these cancers, but very soon they become resistant. So that's a big challenge. These are very aggressive cancers. Now, two proteins which I would be focusing today is estrogen receptor alpha. And as you can see here, I already mentioned that the distribution of estrogen receptor alpha expression in the different subtypes of breast cancer. And another one is ER beta, which I will not be talking today, but I just want to show you that it's not just one receptor. Conventionally, breast cancer have been divided into ER negative and ER positive simply based on, for historical reasons, that classification is based on estrogen receptor alpha, because when ER was known to be a target of estrogen, the only receptor known was ER alpha. So the classification made ER minus and plus. But now, about three decades ago, another member of this family was discovered called ER beta. So even though you call this as triple negative, in fact they are not triple negative. They do express ER beta protein, so on receptor. They are only triple negative with respect to ER alpha. So just to keep in mind, I won't be talking today about estrogen receptor beta. I will just touch upon the last one slide or so, what's its significance and which type of breast cancer mainly, but mostly it will be estrogen receptor alpha. And the other protein is obviously familiar one to all of you. It is the P53. So P53 is mutated in breast cancer. Overall, P53 mutation in breast cancer, if you look at, is not as huge as in many other cancers. About 25% of all breast cancers have P53 mutation. However, if you look at the subclasses of this breast cancer, then you would see how important this protein is. So for example, in the luminal breast cancer, luminal A, P53 mutation is about 12%. Luminal B jumps considerably to 29%. And in the HER2, it is about 72% P53 is mutated. And the highest rate of P53 mutation is 80%. So 80%, that's a really huge challenge in terms of to treating these cancers, part of the reason. So now, I should mention that these are all what I'm talking about is somatic mutations, because most of the breast cancer arise from somatic mutations, although germline mutations are important in certain breast cancers. I don't know how many of you heard day before yesterday's presentation by Judy Garber from Dana Harbor. So she was mainly focusing on germline mutations in different types of cancer. So germline mutations are important, but a vast majority of breast cancers are due to somatic mutations. In some of these genes, I'll come to that in a moment. So P53 mutations are infrequent in ER-alpha positive breast cancer. 70 to 80% of tumors have wild-type P53. Our P53 is functionally inactive. So that's something to note, which is relevant to the rest of the my presentation as well. So we would think that if P53 is not mutated, it is a wild-type, it should be active. Many cases it is true, but in many cases, even though P53 is genetically wild-type, it can be functionally debilitated or compromised by various interaction with other proteins or pathways downstream to the P53 pathway, or sometimes even upstream, can be defective in a cell, ultimately resulting in an inactive P53 pathway. So mutation per se is not necessary to inactivate a P53. There are other ways to inactivate it. Now, ER negative, alpha negative tumors express mutant P53, for example, so the triple negative breast cancer. Now, 80% of triple negative or TNBC express mutant P53 and ER beta. So this phenomenon was known among the pathologists for a long time, that whenever they look under microscope, using immunohistochemistry, ER-positive breast cancers always, most of the time have wild-type P53, and ER-negative tumors have mutant P53. No one knew what to make out of it, because that was years ago when there was no potential conceivable connection between two very different proteins belonging to different classes like P53 and estrogen receptor. So, but now we know that there is a crosstalk between these two important proteins, although they are functionally poles apart. So if you now look at the what you call the TCGA database, and just to give you a taste of it, don't worry about all the details and numbers here. So if you look at here the predicted somatic mutations, so this, the right hand side panel here, sorry, the left, when you are looking at it, you are left when you are on the screen, right side. So you can see several important proteins, which you are already familiar in one context or the other, are altered in these. So, for example, P53 is altered in all these different types of subclasses, as you already saw, and it is the highest. The gray shades, then the width of it represents how much, what's the frequency of these different type of protein mutations. Here you can see that it is highly high here. And the percentage is given here, for example, total about 37% from this database, from this analysis. Luminal A12, you already saw that in my previous slide. Luminal B29, HER2 72, and basal 80%. So, and if, on the other hand, if you look at PI3K kinase, you can see that those percentages are different. More or less, they are evenly distributed, except in the basal, like you would see very low, whereas P53 is the highest. So these different, although breast cancer is one word, but it comes in very different forms. All these forms are different, in fact, and the treatment response to treatment is very different. And some of them don't have a treatment regimen yet. And now if you look at the correlation between the clinical data, which I already alluded to, so ER, PR, HER2, the presence of their expression is depicted here. Again, if you look at, for example, ER is present in many of these, and HER2, if you look at here, the HER2 protein is enriched in here. And if you look at the copy number status, of these different genes, some of these different genes, you can see it's not only point mutations, but the copy numbers of some of these genes are very different. Just as an example to show you, in the HER2 overexpressing breast cancer, HER2 gene or RBB2 gene is highly amplified in red, amplification denoted by red and deletion denoted by blue. And you can see that P53 and AMPK, so genes like that are, in many cases, they are deleted in addition to the point mutations. Now this is to show you again the heterogeneity of breast cancer at the molecular level. If you just look at this one protein, very important protein, which is TP53, and different type of mutations, frame shift, in frame, missense, nonsense, and splice mutations. I assume you all know what is these terminologies means. If you don't know, let me know. All of you are familiar with this terminology, right? Okay. So, and if you look at here, these mutation rates are very different in terms of the frame shift mutations are not as much, even though they are uniformly distributed across the whole, protein coding region of this gene. Whereas the somatic mutations, the missense mutation, are pretty high. The dark green, this one, they are concentrated towards the middle of the protein, which is the DNA binding domain of the protein, which is necessary to bind to the cognate sites in the human genome. And some of the other regions of this protein are also mutated with a light green, you can see here. And then the missense mutations there are, and the splice mutations are by far fewer, but they are still, a type of mutations present in this protein, in this gene. Now, further, more recently, these breast cancer have been further divided into multiple classes based on our increased knowledge of molecular differences. So here, all these pie diagrams show you that to what extent these different types of mutations in P53 are present in these different subtypes of breast cancer. Here is a basal-like HER2, luminal A, luminal B, and normal-like cancers. And as you can see, overall, if you look at the height of different colored bars, you can see they are the highest in the basal-like, which is what I told you a few slides ago. And now, more recently, this particular cancer, this basal-like cancer, has been, further divided among various other subgroups. So total now, it was only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but now we have about 10 molecular subgroups within the breast cancer. And again, there it is subgroup 10, molecular group 10 or integrated group 10, what the others call them, have the highest P53 mutation. So this group is very, a lot of similarities with the basal-like cancer when they subdivide this. But again, the point of showing this is that all these different type of subtypes of breast cancers have different extent of mutations in P53. So this is just an example. Now, if you look at other genes, the same phenomenon you will see very different. So that is an important point to remember, how heterogeneous this disease is, and that is one factor which underlies how difficult it is to treat this cancer. Now, P53, as a major tumor suppressor, when it is mutated, many of its tumor suppressor functions are, altered or compromised. In addition, the mutant P53 gain a lot of functions which are oncogenic in nature. So they are called gain of function mutations. So they not only lose their ability to suppress cancer, but at the same time they gain the ability to drive cancer. So those are there. So some of the general cellular pathways affected by these various mutations are shown here. So the types of changes like tumor growth and development, metastasis and early tumorigenesis, different stages of cancer are all affected by any of the, you can rotate this outer wheel against the inner wheel. You can see any of these different pathways can impinge on any of these stages in breast cancer, and all these stages involve one way or the other P53. So and the estrogen receptor is a protein which obviously is extremely important, even though it is considered as a so-called villain when it comes to the breast cancer, but it is very important in normal mammary gland development and in adult physiology as well, as you know. And P53 is a major tumor suppressor, as we consider from in the angle of cancer it is a hero, but there is no strict hero and villain concept when it comes to real biology. Both these proteins are very essential for the normal physiological functions in human or for many animals as well. There is a delicate balance between these two proteins. You can't have too much of either of these. That balance in normal cells is somehow disrupted in cancers such as breast cancer, and that's what is causing, for example, estrogen receptor is pretty high in breast cancer, and P53 is either mutated or this particular protein can bind and inactivate this protein. So that balance is disrupted. That's what causing one of the main causes of the molecular level or cellular level for this disease. Now, so what we had shown over several years is that estrogen receptor can directly bind to P53. Okay, and so using various technical approaches, which are shown here, I wouldn't have time to go into any of those details, just to tell you that by multiple approaches we had shown out here that it directly binds to P53. We mapped the domain, we know which region of P53 binds to which region of estrogen receptor and all those things. So this, for example, we know that how these proteins bind together to the genome, and this is again, I'm assuming that you might have heard in some of the technique course if you have taken already, or from some other lectures, chromatin immunoprecipitation assay, right? So here I am not going to take you through the details or anything, just to show you one of the main techniques we used in this analysis is this one. And so basically we look at where P53 is binding and ER is piggybacking on P53, and we can analyze it using the chromatin immunoprecipitation assay. And another assay, so that one, for that immunoprecipitation assay, like regular immunoprecipitation or chromatin immunoprecipitation, you have to grind the cells and make an extract to do that assay. Whereas the other assay which we have used is what is called a proximity ligation assay. And in this particular case, you don't have to cut open the cells. You can visualize the interaction in situ based on two different antibodies targeted against your protein of interest, in this particular case, ER and P53. So when they are very close together, about 10 angstrom or something like that, then these two the antibodies are linked to oligonucleotides, and they come together and form a rolling cycle. Circular DNA, and which undergoes what is called rolling cycle amplification. The ultimate result is some extent like PCR multiple copies, but it's not a PCR reaction. And the last step in this one, a oligonucleotide complementary to this but carrying a fluorophore is added. So the signals you get very bright fluorescent dots like this if these proteins are close enough. If they are not close enough, you don't see any signal. So this is just an real experiment where we have normal regular cells which has treated with a non-specific siRNA, and here we knock down estrogen receptor alpha using specific siRNA. So when one partner is gone, you don't get the signal. So that's just one of the techniques which we used even also in the clinical trial, which I'm going to mention in a few moments. So this is again, just to quickly take you through estrogen receptor signaling. So this pathway you are already familiar. So this pathway through the various MAP kinase and RAS pathways sometimes can lead to phosphorylation of estrogen receptor and activate it and enabling it to activate many of its target genes from various target genes in the genome. And in other cases, estrogen receptor, most of its functions are in the nucleus, although there are some cytoplasmic functions or even membrane functions. So some of the drugs used to in breast cancer, for example, tamoxifen, which will bind the estrogen receptor and prevent estrogen from binding, because estrogen is in most cases needed to activate this receptor. But if tamoxifen binds it, estrogen cannot bind it, prevents it. So tamoxifen is called a selective estrogen receptor modulator, or SERM, because it can bind and modify its functional characteristics. And another one is used in breast cancer therapy is called the fulvestrant. That one, what it does is it binds and destroys or degrades estrogen receptors. So that comes under a class of compounds called the SERDs, selective estrogen receptor degraders. Yet another important strategy to block the estrogen receptor signaling is to go after the estrogen synthesis. So that step, this particular step, the rate limiting step, is catalyzed by an enzyme called aromatase. So the inhibitors against aromatase are used to block that. So especially this treatment is mainly relevant for in patients, breast cancer patients who are postmenopausal, because this enzyme particularly very active in the breast tissue, so you can block that using these aromatase inhibitors. But in most cases, still the mainstay of therapy is tamoxifen. So the conventional concept about estrogen receptor is what I showed you, just what I just told you. It will bind estrogen, will bind estrogen receptor, which can then bind to its cognate target sites in the genome. And in presence of estrogen, the co-activators are recruited, and a whole bunch of genes which are pro-proliferative are activated. Presence of anti-estrogens like tamoxifen, or for that matter, fulvestrant. The especially tamoxifen, co-repressors are recruited instead of co-activators, and these genes are silenced. So that's one of the ways this particular drug works. Now, what we had shown years ago is that in addition to this conventional role, ER can also be recruited to the bind P53. Even though it doesn't have to directly bind to the genes as such, gene promoters, but it can piggyback on P53. So what happens is here, it is the whole property of this receptor changes when it is binding this way versus when it is binding directly. Here estrogen will activate this receptor by recruiting co-activators. Here what it does is that instead of recruiting co-activators, it will recruit co-repressors here. So basically what would happen is that this particular gene, which is usually a P53 target gene, which is anti-proliferative function, will be repressed. And if you have anti-estrogens like tamoxifen, that will disrupt this interaction and thereby prevent the silencing activity of the estrogen receptor. So from this, what you can see is that estrogen receptor has a dual function. One, it will activate the presence of estrogen, pro-proliferative genes. On the other hand, in the presence of estrogen, again, it can suppress anti-proliferative genes, which are usually p53 targets. So the both ways can drive the uncontrolled proliferation of breast cancer cells. So this is the based on crystallographic studies. So ER bound to estradiol, that's what you see here. This is a helix 12, which is one of the main helix at the business site of this receptor. And when it is bound to raloxifene, which is similar anti-estrogen like tamoxifen, you can see that this helix's conformation is drastically changed. It just throws out here when tamoxifen or raloxifene bind. And that is when this is in this conformation, estrogen can no longer bind here. And that's how it blocks estrogen function in the cell. It's the same situation here. Instead of raloxifene, here it is tamoxifen, which is the drug we will be talking a little more today. So here, what you see here is that, as I showed you two slides ago, the co-activator or co-repressor concept. So co-activator peptide is shown in this golden color here. And this pink or magenta color is the helix 12. And this is a molecule used for in this particular crystallographic studies instead of estradiol, which was used in the previous slide, diethyl salbutamol, very similar structure compound. And you can see that the helix is in very similar position as in the previous slide I showed you with the estradiol. And in the case of tamoxifen, again, hydroxytamoxifen, like the raloxifene as you saw here, this helix is thrown out here, all the way, helix 12. So this drastically changes the conformation of the receptor, disabling it to bind a co-activator here. There is no co-activator here. So these are all from real crystallographic models based on crystallographic studies. Now, tamoxifen is, as I told you, widely used in breast cancer treatment. And its discovery itself is very interesting, which I wouldn't have time to go into any detail today. I just want to focus more on the clinical trial side of this. So here, the SERM, so as I mentioned, has to be metabolized in the body. It undergoes metabolism and in the liver by various metabolizing enzymes. I'll show you in a more detailed one in a moment. And tamoxifen, only 40% of it is bioavailable with all these metabolization going on in the body, whereas raloxifen is even less. It's only 2%. That's one of the reasons raloxifen is not used very much in the clinic, although the structural properties of these two drugs are very similar. So tamoxifen, the main metabolic the main metabolic enzymes involved in this are mentioned here. As you can see, this is the main pathway or the main conversion occurring to tamoxifen into N-desmethyl tamoxifen. And this one, the CYP2C6, is the main enzyme involved in converting this tamoxifen to 4-hydroxytamoxifen, and that can further be converted to N-deoxifen, which is one of the main very important metabolite which has effect on estrogen receptor. So you can see that this drug and its metabolites are very important in when you consider the treatment of patients. So usually, since this has undergoes, this is how about 100-fold more powerful or strong compared to tamoxifen. So that's why in the cell culture, any one of you do the experiment, you usually use 4-hydroxytamoxifen because there is no metabolizing machinery in a cell as compared to an intact animal or a human body. In humans, usually the drug is tamoxifen citrate, what is given here is also directly tamoxifen. It undergoes metabolism as I showed you in the previous slide. So this is a zooming in on those enzymes responsible, you can see that there are several enzymes here and involved in tamoxifen metabolism. And the tamoxifen will block the estrogen receptor and block, in turn blocking the estrogen, you know, the this particular activation step by estrogen. That's what it is doing here. And this estrogen receptor, as I told you, functions in the nucleus to activate or regulate various types of target genes. And some of these I circled in bold red. These are the ones which we would be, we have looked at in the clinical trial, because they are CYP-D26, for example, is a very important enzyme. Now, the hypothesis we had for the, before we started the clinical trial, was that since we showed that ER can bind wild type p53 and inactivate it, drugs such as tamoxifen, we showed in the lab in cell culture models that tamoxifen can disrupt this interaction and reactivate wild type p53. So that's one of the ways this tamoxifen works. Other conventional way, what was known before, was that tamoxifen can prevent estrogen from binding, which is true. But what we discovered in our lab is that in addition to that phenomenon, it can disrupt this protein-protein interaction. Now, if in cases where P53 is mutated, this particular phenomenon will be of no benefit to the patients, because even if the interaction is disrupted, or you are releasing is still genetically mutant P53, this case, this situation might even lead to worse outcome, but we have not studied this side of the coin, but mostly we have focused on this side. So, when we saw that in the cell culture models, we wanted to see whether this phenomenon indeed exists in patients. So we started what is called a retrospective clinical trial. I assume somebody covered it previously, retrospective trials and prospective trials. Did anybody? Not really? Okay, any retrospective, as the name implies, it's simple. It is the study is based on some studies which already was done for, not necessarily for that particular purpose. Then you use that data or those samples to analyze what you are interested in, to see whether what's happening there. So this is, in other words, this particular trial is not designed or conducted for the specific reason what you want to study, okay, or a specific phenomenon you want to study. So, but you go back and analyze the existing data or existing sample, clinical samples, to see what is, whether the phenomenon you are interested can be studied there. So that's what we did first. So we collaborated with a breast cancer group in Germany who had a big collection of breast cancer patient tumors, and these patients are treated with tamoxifen and followed for about 15 years, their response. So we took a sampling of those type of breast tissues and looked at two different types of them, ER positive and wild type P53, and also ER positive cancers expressing mutant P53, and then looked at how is their overall survival or cumulative survival over these 15 years or so. So as you can see here, this is called the Kaplan-Meier curves. The curves which are representing patients with ER positive and wild type P53 is flatter than those ER positive but mutant P53 expressing tumors. So in other words, wild type P53 expressing ER positive tumors are more sensitive to tamoxifen therapy, or they respond better. So that was the conclusion. So that is consistent with this observation, but it still doesn't, it's a correlation, it doesn't prove it. We have not looked at the real patients whether tamoxifen, in the absence of tamoxifen, whether the P53 and ER are in together. And if you treat them with tamoxifen, they are separate or they are disrupted. We don't know that. But it's a correlative evidence, so it supports that one. So in order to really nail down if it is indeed this is what is the situation before tamoxifen therapy, and this is the situation after tamoxifen therapy. We decided to start a prospective clinical trial here at Roseville. So this is the type of study which we did here was what is called a prospective window of opportunity neoadjuvant phase 2 clinical trial. I don't know whether any of these terminologies you came across in the previous lectures. Okay, good. So I don't have to go into that. So basically, this treatment was the whole trial was based on treating the patients for about 4 weeks when after they come into the clinic while they are waiting for surgery. The first step in many of the ER positive breast cancer is to do a surgery. That remove the tumor first. So while they are waiting for, because there are all other formalities they have to go through, so during that time, about 4 weeks, we will treat the one group of patients with tamoxifen and the other group will not. We cannot prolong the treatment more than 4 weeks because then it becomes unethical. We are preventing them from getting the regular treatment and what all the different combinations or whatever. Even though they all get tamoxifen initially, but we cannot, becomes unethical to treat them more than that. So, the specific aim of the studies was investigate the status of ER-alpha P53 interaction in ER-positive P53 wild-type breast tumors in untreated patients and examine the how tamoxifen therapy impacts this interaction, determine the effect of reactivation of P53 by tamoxifen on gene expression in breast tumors. So those are the two specific aims we started with. And so this trial, it was conducted in collaboration with a breast surgeon at that time, who was here, Dr. Kulkarni, who since moved to Chicago, and she's at present at the Northwestern University. When this trial was being done, she was at the University of Chicago Medical School. So when we started the trial here several years ago, it took us several years to complete the trial because, as I told you, even if you have everything in place, unlike ordering cell lines or ordering chemicals to do an in vitro experiment or ordering animals, you can't order the patients. You have to wait for the right type of patients to come by and you have to get their consent for this particular trial. And many of them, as you know, that when they are diagnosed with breast cancer, they are very nervous. Many of them don't care about any study. They want to see whether their cancer can be cured right away or not. Because here to involve in a clinical trial like this, they know that whatever results we get most likely will not be beneficial to them in their lifetime. So you have to have patients have to be a little bit altruistic to participate in any of this type of clinical trial. So that is one of the reason that it took a lot of time because the patient accrual takes goes usually slowly. So each clinical trial has eligibility criteria, what type of patients can be recruited and what types of patients cannot be recruited to the patient, to the trial. So the eligibility criteria, one is the inclusion criteria, and the purpose of showing is just not to walk you through all these, or you don't have to remember all these, obviously. So these are just to, if you go through this one, you know that for there is a specific reason for each of these inclusion criteria here. And the exclusion criteria also, there are reasons. There are, of course, one reason is that male patients are not eligible because we focused mainly on the estrogen receptor and tamoxifen treatment or female breast cancer. And for example, the pregnant and lactating women are not eligible. Prior therapy patients who had prior therapy are excluded because we wanted to look at the effect of tamoxifen on this molecular interaction between these two proteins. So if they have already treated with something else, that could have affected those interactions or the proteins. So we would not get the right results. And there is other diseases, they shouldn't have other diseases like cardiovascular, renal, hepatic, and then psychiatric or addictive disorders that would preclude obtaining informed consent. So that's one reason, because they may not consent in a mental state if they are. So we don't want them to have any of such disorders, because then we don't know whether they're really willingly agreeing to the trial or not. And the patient known or suspected to have hypercoagulable syndrome or with history of venous or arterial thrombosis, stroke, or pulmonary embolism. The reason to exclude those patients is that one of the side effects of tamoxifen is that it has a tendency to coagulate the blood. So in some patients. So you don't want that situation in these patients. Women with non-invasive disease or micro-invasion, not eligible. Women undergoing neoadjuvant chemotherapy are not eligible, obviously. Women undergoing tamoxifen and raloxifen, that's what we are going to study, so we don't want them already. If somebody has already been on that, that's not what we are looking for. Patients shall not receive any herbal alternative therapies such as flaxseed or soy products, because all these has the potential to affect the receptor signaling or even for that matter P53 function. And P53, the gene non-mutation, patients with a non-gene mutation in P53, which is Lee from any syndrome. So that's an example of germline mutation, because those patients definitely come out with the various types of cancers, breast cancer being one of the predominant forms of those cancers in hereditary cancer in what is called Lee from any syndrome. So you don't want that type. If any of the patients coming here with the breast cancer belong to that category, we exclude those patients. We wouldn't bring them into this trial. So now the trial design is what is shown here. So as I mentioned, we recruit patients with ER positive breast cancer. And about, these numbers are approximate numbers here shown here. Well, we divide them into two groups. One will have no intervention. In other words, they will not get any type of drug other than the placebo. And the other group will get 4 weeks of 20 milligram orally tamoxifen. This is the usual dose when these patients are given for real treatment. So for about 4 weeks, after 4 weeks, they undergo the usual surgery, resect the tumor. And these tumors are used to generate what is called a tissue microarray. So we have tissues from these patients are arrayed on a block of paraffin. And so the idea is that you can make very 0.5 micron sections of those TMA and stain them with any antibody against any protein of your interest. And we will use the immunohistochemistry to look at the estrogen receptor P53 and their selected targets. In parallel, we would also look at the P53 mutation status. So I told you 80% of these patients are expected to be wild type P53 based on my first slide. But we have to confirm that indeed we are dealing with the wild type P53. That's the particular aim of this clinical trial. So how we decided was that by next generation massively parallel DNA sequencing, so we ascertained the P53 mutation. Turned out that indeed 80% of these tumors were wild type P53 and the rest were mutant. So the mutant P53 patients were not processed for this trial. So we restricted the trial to wild type P53 patients. And also we looked at estrogen receptor P53 interaction by in situ PLA on this tissue microarray. So immunohistochemistry will tell you how much of this protein is expressed, whereas this particular technique. PLA will tell you how much of the interaction between these two proteins are existing in the in this tumors of these patients. And now the targets, gene targets of both P53 and ER, we would look at how that got affected by tamoxifen exposure or tamoxifen therapy by using the technique RNA sequencing, using again massively parallel sequencing. And the other technique we used is called reverse phase protein array, or RPPA, to look at proteins, differential expression of proteins in these patients. So both RNA and proteins, we are looking at how they got affected. Now, another thing is that from these tumors, we take a core biopsy and use them to analyze tamoxifen and active metabolites. In one of the previous slides, I showed you different major metabolites of tamoxifen. So we measured them using the, you know, the high tech approach of like the HPLC method here in our shared core facility. So we have that information, and then in parallel again we looked at the tamoxifen metabolizing enzymes. You saw in the previous slide quite a few of them. We looked at them by, you know, because that type of study is called pharmacogenomics. How their those genes have particular SNPs or single nucleotide polymorphism which will affect their activity. If there has a particular SNP or which affects their activity, either increased activity or decreased activity, that will affect how effective the tamoxifen therapy is. So we wanted to get that information, because these patients again are not like animals or cell line. If you get a particular strain of animals from a vendor, you know that all of them are exactly the same. But here, each patient, if we have 23 patients who are treated with tamoxifen, all 23 are very different individuals. Their molecular profiles need not be very same, including these enzymes. So we wanted to know how these pharmacogenomic profile of these tamoxifen metabolizing enzymes look like. And as I told you again, this is all done using the plasma, and this is using the tissue, and we also do the same tamoxifen metabolites using the plasma also, both pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. So this is again the slide which I showed you. These are the ones which we looked for the SNPs in that the previous scheme. That's what we analyzed here. So this study we completed recently, as I mentioned. So this one, as you can see, a clinical trial involves various players here, starting from basic researchers, just myself, and at that time, a graduate student, Wendy Swedzik, and then the surgeon who I collaborated, Swati Kulkarni, and he's one of the postdoc in my lab, and Steve Elge, you heard yesterday. He was involved in recruiting the patients along with Swati. And Jianmin Wing Wang is the bioinformatics expert here, and John Wilton is the metabolomics or the metabolite analysis I mentioned was done by him. And Araba Ajay, who was here, no longer here now, did the pharmacogenomic part. And pharmacodynamics is being done as we speak now by Robert Bees and his lab people. And Alan Hudson and Adrian are the biostatisticians involved in this study, because there are a lot of statistical evaluations to be done. Carl Morrison as the head of the pathology, and Jerry Fetterly, like John Wilton, also at that time in the same group. And Shiksha Kumar was another breast cancer surgeon who is not Roswell anymore now. And also Helen Capuzzi, is also a breast oncologist. So you can see that so many people are involved in this particular study, because it is very multidisciplinary. That's one of the characteristics of any of this type of clinical trial. And so the other important thing to remember is that most clinical trial you might have heard or you will come across is that usually the companies have certain drugs, they want to evaluate it in patients, so they send it to, they set up collaboration with researchers or clinicians, institutes or universities like ours. And but this particular trial, as you, as I took you, started from a basic research happened right here, and we could take it all the way to the clinic, because once we realized that tamoxifen can influence ERP53 interaction in cell culture, that's what triggered the hypothesis that okay, this may be have relevance to tamoxifen therapy. Because even though tamoxifen, theoretically you would know that tamoxifen binds estrogen receptor, it is the competitive inhibitor for estrogen, so theoretically it should work in all ER positive breast cancers. However, in real life, in the clinic, many of these ER positive patients do not respond to tamoxifen. What's the reason for it is still not clear. There are various mechanisms have been looked into, and some of them are more feasible than others. So when we saw that treatment can affect ERP53 interaction, that's when we hypothesized that interaction between these two important proteins, estrogen receptor and P53, could play a role in the tamoxifen resistance. So why some people, some ER positive tumor are responsive to tamoxifen and some are not responsive to tamoxifen. So that was the main aim from this clinical trial. So the results of this trial, I don't have the time to go through the data, and also the data is still coming as I speak. It's almost completed, but it might take few more weeks or a month to complete the whole thing before we send it out for publication. So the main conclusion from this trial is that tamoxifen disrupts ERP53 interaction in luminal breast cancer patient tissues, leading to reactivation of P53. Genes representing several pathways, especially metabolic pathways, are differentially expressed in tumors from patients treated with tamoxifen. And this particular study provides insight into the mechanism underlying favorable response of wild-type P53 to tamoxifen therapy. And it has implications towards stratifying ER-positive breast cancer patients to those who will or will not respond to tamoxifen therapy. So that is the important point to note, because it provides important input into the importance of a therapeutic strategy based on P53 status dependent stratification of ER positive breast cancer. Right now, as I mentioned, any patient who walks to the clinic with a ER positive breast cancer are put on tamoxifen therapy, and many of them will not be responsive to therapy, will not be helped by this therapy, and so they have to put up with all the side effects of tamoxifen without getting any anti-tumor effect. So this trial, of course, this is a pilot trial. We have to expand it into a larger trial, and if that, there also, if it succeeds, we can say that we have identified a way to stratify ER-positive breast cancer into those who will or will not respond to tamoxifen therapy. So that's one of the aim of this study. And this stratification will be based on the tumor suppressor P53. So that's the outcome, going to be the outcome of this study. And now, in the next couple of minutes, I just want to show you. So far, we only talked about ER-positive luminal breast cancer. So what about ER-negative breast cancer, which is triple-negative? So these are some of the therapeutic options right now which is followed in the clinic. One is the anthracyclines, for example, doxorubicin-like drugs, which would intercalate into the DNA and stop the DNA replication. So that's one general chemotherapeutic drug. And some of these pathways you are already familiar. I'm not going to walk you through the red ones are, you know, tumor suppressor proteins, and these ones are the oncogenic proteins and all that. So they are all different combinations. They are being targeted, but PARP inhibitor was a big news few years ago, but the results was frustrating in the clinical trial because this did not have the intended effect against this type of tumors. But so now people are trying various combinations of this particular therapeutic strategy. And another one is the taxanes. It targets the microtubules in the cell so that it blocks the right partition of chromosomes, thereby leading to defective cells which would be eliminated. So that's another strategy, another drug which is very frequently used against this particular type of cancers. So as I told you, this is very difficult to treat cancer. All these are only not very efficient drugs in this category. So there is a intense effort going on to find new drugs for this. So basically what we have done is that use cell culture models, animal models, and clinical studies, one from one to the other to the other. I didn't have much time today to talk about the animal experiments involved in before we embarked on the clinical trial, but as you can see here, and we learn from these, and if there is a potential opportunity, we go forward with the clinical studies. And from this clinical study, for example, the particular one I explained, we learned a lot of things. And now we can go back to the lab and use that in designing our future experiments. So that's the way it is, the back and forth interaction between these different type of studies which we do. Okay, so I would stop you there, stop it, and then ask if you have any questions. Nobody has questions?
Thank you.